Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 21st, 2017. The outgoing UN peacekeeping boss comes to Juba with a strong message before he steps down.
We are sparing no effort to speed up, and I think I can say that in the next few weeks you will see the first vanguard of the Regional Protection Force being deployed actually here in Juba. And that, I think, will be a very important signal.
And rights groups say freedom of expression is a human right.
How can we have a national dialogue if there is no freedom of expression? So it's important to make sure that freedom of expression is really at the top of the priority right now, even from the political agenda that we have.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The outgoing UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations say the Kiir administration must first silence the guns across South Sudan to create a safe environment for the national dialogue. Speaking to reporters in Juba, Javier Lesus says Juba should first resolve problems facing the country to achieve genuine consensus through national dialogue. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from the capital, Juba.
Harvey Latsous visited Juba along with his designated successor, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, to meet with President Salva Kiir and other top officials yesterday. Latsous describes security and humanitarian conditions in South Sudan as dire. He says the situation requires a political solution and President Kiir's national dialogue is not a solution to South Sudan's many problems.
A national dialogue, of course, is most usefully held in a context where hostilities have ceased, that there is no more fighting, first. Second, that the humanitarian context is not perhaps as bad as it is right now. You know, when people are concerned about their very basic livelihood, maybe they don't have so much time to spare for political dialogue. Third, of course, it's also very important that the process be as inclusive as possible.
Latsous says the South Sudan government must drive the national dialogue toward a great consensus, saying it can be a catalyst for peace. At the same time, he wants open dialogue cannot be a substitute for a political solution to the fighting gripping the country. Latsous steps down as the UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations in 10 days. During his last visit to Juba as Undersecretary General, he urged all sides to implement the 2015 peace agreement, noting the UN is not pleased about the way the deal has been all but ignored. Latsous says the warring parties continue to block aid workers from accessing people in need of humanitarian assistance across the country.
We have faced at various points a number of impediments in terms of freedom of movement, in terms of freedom of getting clearances. Very importantly, the humanitarian actors have been severely impeded in their action on the ground.
Latsous says South Sudan is one of those countries in the world where there is the most incidence of humanitarian workers being prevented from doing their work, where workers are actually killed trying to help the most needy. Latsous says the African Union, the United Nations and other stakeholders of the peace deal continue trying to engage the warring parties to end the fighting and fully implement the agreement. Without mentioning dates, Latsous says he expects the first wave of the UN-backed Regional Protection Force to be deployed to South Sudan within weeks.
We did lose time because there were a number of slownesses in getting clearances, authorizations here, but we are sparing no effort to speed up, and I think I can say that in the next few weeks you will see the first vanguard of the Regional Protection Force being deployed actually here in Juba, and that I think will be a very important signal you know, that things are moving ahead.
Latsous says tomorrow when he arrives in New York, he will attend another meeting on the status of those deployments, which he calls very important. The forces will consist of several units from Rwanda, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Ethiopia, among other countries. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Rights activists speaking at a forum in Juba today say the government should guarantee freedom of expression during the national dialogue to allow South Sudanese to express themselves freely. An official with South Sudan Human Rights Commission agrees that freedom of expression is a fundamental right. Tito Justin has this report for VOA from Juba.
Michael Duku, executive director of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, says the country has a clear record of human rights violations and activists trying to ensure that authorities allow freedom of expression at this month's national dialogue have their work cut out for them.
We cannot practice democracy if this important fundamental freedom of expression is lacking. So that means that democracy will not be full if freedom of expression is deficient. Because drivers like the media is adding value to the voices of all the masses of the country to contribute towards sustainable development.
Eugen Nindorera, director of the Human Rights Department at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan North, Chapter 5 of the 2015 Agreement to Resolve Conflict in South Sudan is about peace, truth and reconciliation. He says that cannot happen if the government bars freedom of expression and continues to crack down on the media. He says it will be hard to resolve intercommunal differences if South Sudanese are not allowed to speak freely about past grievances.
How can we have a national dialogue if there is no freedom of expression? So it's important to make sure that freedom of expression is really at the top of the priority right now, even from the political agenda that we have.
Nual Justin Yak, acting chairperson of South Sudan Human Rights Commission, agrees that freedom of expression is essential during the national dialogue. Yak insists the government will work closely with the media to ensure that freedom of expression is protected during the dialogue process.
Freedom of expression is what will take us out from our situation as a South Sudanese. I would like to invite the media. We will cooperate and we give hand what we needed from you. Just set up your agenda and we will table it for you.
Edward Lado Tarso, Secretary General of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, says it will be impossible for most South Sudanese to participate unless the media is allowed to report freely. Tarso says a majority of South Sudanese rely on radio for information. He says authorities should allow radio stations and other media to report freely so the people can follow statements made during the national dialogue.
It is used by 80% of the population who are actually illiterate. If that freedom is not there, the national dialogue will not succeed. Because whatever is discussed, whatever is agreed, a great big section of the society will not know anything about it. So anything done in the dark will not be very fruitful.
And if that happens, Laduwon's participation will be very low. He is urging the Kiir administration to guarantee freedom of expression and protect journalists across the country during the national dialogue and afterwards. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
South Sudan's aviation authorities have hiked landing fees for all commercial airlines flying to South Sudan. The manager of Juba International Airport, Kur Kual, says effective this month, all commercial flights landing at Juba International Airport will pay $4,000. Last month, commercial flights paid $200 as landing fees. Kual says all United Nations flights are exempted from the new charges. He says South Sudanese registered airlines will pay 9,000 South Sudanese pounds, which is less than $100. Kual says the new fees were introduced due to the economic crisis. The new charges will likely force airlines companies to increase the prices of tickets on flights in and out of Juba, affecting most South Sudanese who depend on planes for their travels.
Yeah, actually, it is true. The Ministry of Finance actually made in this year, to increase some charges. And even they drop some of the charges. Not all charges have been put. Yeah, there are a few.
Let's say a plane like Kenya Airways or Air Rwanda, how much do they pay to land at Juba International Airport?
Yeah, according to that increment, say $4,000.
Kenya Airways will pay $4,000 as landing fees at Juba International Airport.
Yes.
When is it effective?
This month.
From March onward, they will pay $4,000.
Yes.
And how about other airlines that are registered inside South Sudan, like the South Spring and other companies? How much are they going to pay you?
They will pay 9,100 SFC.
Which is like how many dollars? I don't know the exchange rate in the country, but how many dollars are these 9,000 SSP?
Yeah, actually, I cannot tell you exactly how the exchange is just up and down. So, but officially, it is because of this economic crisis. But South Sudan, $1 was against two pounds, Southern Sudanese. So due to this current crisis, economic crisis, that is why sometimes it has reached higher and it can go down. So I cannot tell you exactly the exchange rate, how much the exchange rate, but I know you think $1 is against £2. It was international like that.
Okay. These new changes, is it affecting every plane? We have the UN, which is having a lot of flights in South Sudan. Are they also going to pay you $4,000 for landing at Juba International Airport?
No, it's only just affecting only a commercial flight, because there is already bilateral written between the government and UN, so all the UN agencies are not charged.
Before the new charges were introduced, how much was Juba Airport charging commercial flights landing at the airport?
Yeah, actually, that question I cannot answer you well, because they are very far from those charges. So the finance, these are the people know this, but I don't know.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what happened in Wau yesterday. It looks like there were conflicting reports on the passengers who were on that plane. The airline officials, the South Spring officials, were saying there were 45 passengers on the plane. But then people in Wau were saying there were only 20 passengers on the plane. Can you tell us what happened exactly in between when the plane left Juba and by the time it crashed in Wau?
Yeah, actually, the plane left around 2:07 and crashed in 3:25 p.m. Actually, the plane was carrying 44 passengers, in which 39 were adults and one child, and four infants, made a total of 44. And there were five crews. One captain from Russia in nationality, and one co-pilot was a Sudanese. Flight engineer was Sudanese also, and seven crew from South Sudan. So the total was 49. That is exactly the right figure.
But then the plane, when it landed in Wau, there were only 20 passengers on board. Where are the rest?
No. Was 49 until the plane crashed, and all the 49 came out safely.
Okay, all the 49 were rescued.
All of them, none of them died until the time I'm talking to you now.
That's Kur Kwal, manager of Juba International Airport. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the cancer screening for women in South Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how does your community express its hospitality.
My community was from Eastern Equatoria, and my tribe is Peri tribe. For example, once a visitor comes at home, and if a female is there, she has to greet and kneels down. She has to bring water.
When the person moves in the community, we all go and we go and visit the person and get to find out more about the person and welcoming the person to the community.
I think they watch out for people. When you move in newly in the area, people come and say hello.
In my community, they express hospitality in terms of receiving guests, treating them good, providing them an accommodation, shelter, food and drinks.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. And today we are talking about cancer.
Dr. Chan Deng Mayan, the doctor who carried out the screenings at Medicare Health Center in Juba, says...
Sorry about that mix-up in the tape, but a local South Sudanese non-governmental organization called Hope Cancer Foundation is educating communities about the importance of screening for cancer. The Hope Cancer Foundation carried out voluntary cervical cancer screening for more than 200 women in Juba last month. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Dr. Chan Deng Mayan, the doctor who carried out the screenings at Medicare Health Center in Juba, says result released late last week indicates that 7 of the 208 women screened have cervical cancer. A 42-year-old woman who prefers to be identified only as Viola says she was diagnosed with cervical cancer after feeling unwell for nearly 15 years. She says she spent a lot of money seeking treatment but didn't receive the right treatment. Speaking in Arabic, Viola encourages other women to go for periodical checkup so they can know their status and don't have to go what she went through.
I spent nearly 15 months without getting my monthly period. And when I finally had my period, the discharge looked black in color and I felt severe pain in my stomach. I was taken to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The doctors told me that I was pregnant, but there was no child. I was then brought back to Juba, where I spent 9 months at Juba Teaching Hospital, but the doctors could not diagnose the problem.
Viola says doctors at the Juba Teaching Hospital finally refer her to Gulu, a town in northern Uganda, where she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. She is now receiving treatment and hopes to be cured. 39-year-old Martha Kiden came to Medicare Health Center to screen for cancer last month because she could not conceive for the past 20 years. Speaking in Arabic, Kiden says she hopes the doctors can identify a treatment for her sickness.
I have stayed for long without getting another child, and my child is now grown up. For all this time, I have been feeling pain in my uterus, but I could not know the cause of the pain. That is why I came to see if the doctors here could help me get a cure for my problem.
Dr. Chan Deng Mayan carried out the 2 weeks voluntary screening exercise in Juba and sent the sample to Ugandan capital Kampala for further laboratory tests. The results confirm that 7 of the women have cervical cancer, while 12 cases need further tests. Dr. Mayan says the vast majority of the 208 women who took part in the voluntary screening tested negative for cancer.
180 participants, or almost 91.8%, were actually showing negative results, which means that they don't have a cervical cancer, and 3.6% it were actually positive for cervical cancer. And these are the patients that we need to see them again so that we can do more investigation.
By more investigations, Dr. Mayan means grouping the women according to their stage of cancer so that they can receive following treatment, which may include surgery. Worldwide, 4% of women screened have cervical cancer, but Dr. Mayan says only further investigations will confirm how widespread cervical cancer in South Sudan. Mayan says the Hope Cancer Foundation will treat the 7 South Sudanese women who have cervical cancer.
There are so many options for treatment, and some of the options can be done here. Those options that can be done at our level here, we still do them, and we are going to do them free of charge. Then those options we cannot do here, we are going to see with the client on how this thing can be done, because usually we have limited resources and we have limited hand also.
Mayan says some treatment stages might require chemotherapy or radiotherapy, which are very expensive and unavailable in South Sudan. Dr. Mayan says Hope Cancer Foundation plans to carry out a voluntary screening for prostate cancer for men in Juba in September. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Tanzania has announced a plan to send 500 doctors to Kenya after a doctors' strike paralyzed health services in the neighboring country for months. Kenyan doctors, however, say the government should not hire any foreign doctors, but instead employ more than 1,000 trained physicians who are unemployed. Rahel Obor reports from Nairobi.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli announced a plan to dispatch the doctors after a recent meeting in Dar es Salaam with a visiting Kenyan delegation that included Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary, Cleopa Mailu. Mailu said this was a deal that would benefit both countries.
Tuko na vituo vingi vya serikali ambao zinahitaji madaktari.
We have so many government health centers that need doctors, he said. Yes, we have doctors in our country. We recently had a doctor strike, and one of the reasons for the strike was that there was not enough doctors to attend to patients. The doctors were spending a lot of hours attending to the patients. Doctors from public hospitals in Kenya went on strike last December to demand a pay rise and improved working conditions for physicians and patients. A deal struck by the doctors' union and government opened the way to negotiations that ended the 100-day-old strike. According to Mailu, it is because of the doctors' demands that the push to recruit foreign physicians was realized. There is so much work, and we will continue looking for more doctors. We will continue negotiations with the government to see if they will provide us with more doctors so that we can strengthen our health services here in Kenya, he said. Dr. Eli Nyaim of the Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Board says the move may not have been clearly thought out.
The World Health Organization recommendation, so we still have a shortage, even with the ones we produce from our universities. That state actually cuts across the entire East Africa. So Tanzania is actually even worse off than we are in terms of doctor-patient ratio.
The Physicians Union says Kenya currently has 1,400 doctors who have not been absorbed into the workforce. According to the World Health Organization, the Tanzanian doctor-to-patient ratio stands at one doctor for every 20,000 patients. In Kenya, it's one doctor for every 16,000. The recommended doctor-patient ratio is 1 to 300.
It would be very unfortunate that you're actually exporting when you don't have enough yourself. It should not be done at the expense of denying qualified Kenyans positions because you're bringing foreigners.
In a press briefing held after the meeting with the Kenyan delegation, Tanzania's president welcomed the new deal with the Kenyan government. By good luck, our friends have said they will pay good salaries and the payment will be in dollars. They will be given accommodation and security, he said. Health Secretary Mailu says the Tanzanian doctors will start working in Kenya in April and will be given 2 to 3 year contracts. And he says there are plans underway to hire doctors from Cuba. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
As aid agencies organize ramp up to respond to a serious drought across East Africa, one analyst with the Washington-based International Food Policy Research Institute says it's critical for observers to remember that in South Sudan, the main cause of food insecurity and famine is ongoing fighting. Although drought conditions make matters worse, the conflict has exacerbated efforts to help the most needy. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Paul DeRoche, Division Director of Development Strategy and Governance Division for International Food Policy Research Institute, says the drought in East Africa is expected to put hundreds of thousands of lives at risk and could push some countries to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. But in South Sudan, DeRoche says the drought will only worsen the consequences of a man-made disaster that has caused famine in some parts of the country.
You've got drought to some extent in central South Sudan. And that has, you know, led to problems in terms of sufficient water for livestock and for people. But you've got a much bigger factor in South Sudan, and that's the civil war, the insecurity, and that's greatly affected households, both fleeing violence as well as hurting their ability to earn money, to produce food, and so forth.
REACH, a humanitarian research organization, said last month that through data collected on a monthly basis since January 2016, it found that the conflict, coupled with the countrywide economic crisis, caused high levels of food insecurity in Unity State and decreased access to markets. As reported by IREN News, REACH says the conflict has impacted community resilience in Unity State's Leer and Mayendid counties, where famine has been declared, as well as in Cochise County, which the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, has classified as likely to experience famine in the near future.
This ongoing conflict has a serious effect on production, both of crops and livestock, and that's very serious, and that's reducing the availability of food. That can be addressed in part by food aid or government transfers, bringing in food to the region, imports. It could be, in fact, addressed by private markets, private trade bringing in grain. But that's only dealing with the availability issue. You also have to address the issue of access to food of households that have lost their incomes. They no longer are producing as much food as they need. And so there needs to be a mechanism to go from bringing in grain or other types of food and actually getting it to the people who need it most.
And DeRoche says that means you need to come up with a mechanism to provide grain and bring it quickly to the people who need it most. In a new report by the Washington-based rights watchdog, The Enough Project, founding director John Prendergast says it's not a matter of a lack of resources in South Sudan. He says billions of dollars have been spent on the country to support peacekeeping forces and humanitarian assistance. But despite all that diplomatic and monetary support from the international community, conditions have worsened, leading to famine in parts of the country because of bad actors in the government. DeRoche believes famine can be prevented from spreading to other parts of the country if the availability of food, access to food and nutrition is addressed.
One thing clearly is you solve the conflict. You let people exist. You let the country develop. But then part of that means that the government and the private sector, to some extent, need to invest in agricultural production. That's both the crops and the livestock. And then also develop the infrastructure, the roads, the physical markets, to some extent electricity, and so forth, so that the production can grow in the future. Household incomes can rise.
So it's not just coming with better relief mechanisms, but raising productions and making markets work better, according to DeRoche. Close to 5 million people in South Sudan are facing severe food insecurity, while 100,000 people are affected by famine in the country, according to the IPC. There are nearly 3 million in Somalia and 1.8 million people in Nigeria facing severe food insecurity. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with that song by Amy J talking about problems with your in-laws. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.